This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, and I am from Chicago. Well, okay, not really. I'm actually from Chicagoland, as Colonel McCormick is said to have coined it, or Chicago and vicinity, as the maps say. But if I were to tell people I'm from the town of Riverdale or Crete, unless you also grew up in the south suburbs, very few of you are going to have any idea where that is. So I say I'm from Chicago. There's also a certain cachet conveyed by saying one is from Chicago, the city of big shoulders, hog butcher to the world, and all that. No one's writing about that like, writing about the suburbs like that, I should say, with their endless miles of identical houses, chain restaurants, and big box stores. And yet, most of us live in or are from the suburbs, or at least suburban environments. You know who else is from the suburbs? My guest today. His name is Jason Diamond. He says the suburbs are due for a reappraisal. His book is The Sprawl, Reconsidering the Weird American Suburbs. He's also the author of Searching for John Hughes. More on that later. Jason Diamond, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jason, where are you from?
I'm originally from Skokie, Illinois. But I like to tell
people... Oh, you're supposed to say Chicago.
Yeah, you know what? Honestly, after all these years, I moved up and down the lake so much. I usually just tell people that. I moved up and down the lake a lot, but I figured I had to take some pride in being from Skokie, so I just settled on Skokie as the one place.
Sure, sure. All right. So let's begin with a definition. What, for the purposes of our conversation today, in your writing, is a suburb?
I mean, it's really hard to define a suburb. That's been kind of the thing over the years that's been evolving. It's that, you know, it used to be just a place outside of the city where you could commute to the city, but then it kind of expanded from there, and you could live 2 hours from a city and still be in a suburb. So I go with, it's kind of as an editor, you're never supposed to do this, but I go with the dictionary term, and it's an outlier. The suburb is an outlier. It's not the city. It's just anything outside of the city that, to me, in my opinion, going from the dictionary one, is something that's been built up in our post-war world.
Yeah. Well, I'm intrigued because you write in your book, we have so many ideas of what we think suburbia is, yet we don't realize how suburban we've become, whether we live in a suburb or not, end quote. And a lot of our listeners are in downstate cities in Illinois, right, which are not technically suburbs, but with subdivisions and strip malls, they're suburban enough for your purposes, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I live in Brooklyn now. I'm 40, and I've spent over half of my life now living in cities. And even cities have become more suburban. You know, I mean, I could go out my, I mean, not right now I can't, but in the pre-COVID times, and hopefully in the post-COVID times, I could go out my door and go to, you know, any chain restaurant or J. Crew or anything I would find in a mall in the suburbs, not too far from my house in Brooklyn, you know, and it's, that's how suburban we've become, I think, that it blends into our cities and even our rural areas in some cases, with small housing developments, you know, as you said, like in downstate and parts of the country that, you know, you drive for miles and not see anything, and all of a sudden there's this little subdivision in the middle of nowhere of townhouses that looks like it could be in any suburb anywhere in the country.
Yeah, it's like a mode of being as much as it is a geographic place.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you also write, and I love this metaphor, and your book is, for people who haven't had a chance to read it yet, it's sort of filled with pop culture and, you know, references to just a vast array of things. One of the ones that I really enjoyed comes pretty close to the beginning. You write, "The sprawl, not the suburbs, is what I don't like. I want to separate the two to better understand and appreciate these places that are everywhere." And you have a metaphor I really like in the book, and I think the best way into it is through a clip. So let's go to the tape, which is on the forest moon of Endor.
"So, you have accepted the truth. I've accepted the truth that you were once Anakin Skywalker, my father.
That name no longer has any meaning for me.
It is the name of your true self you've only forgotten. I know there is good in you. The Emperor hasn't driven it from you fully.
It is too late for me, son.
All right, Jason, there are going to be people listening to this.
That's great. Thank you.
There are going to be people listening to this who are maybe a little confused by that. Can you explain why I played it, how it's relevant to your book?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because I'm not a big Star Wars person. I always joke I'm a Star Trek person, not a Star Wars person. And I get into a lot of arguments about that. But, I love the analogy of Anakin Skywalker starting out as something good and then turning into Darth Vader. Turning into this evil embodiment of the evil empire, as it is. And I just thought it was a kind of an appropriate metaphor in a lot of ways. And George Lucas and Steven Spielberg and a lot of the big directors from when I was growing up, they wrestle with the idea of suburban identity, and they love the suburbs and hate the suburbs in equal measure. And while Star Wars is in no way a movie about the suburbs, I couldn't help but think about the suburbs as Anakin Skywalker, starting out as this really interesting and genuinely pretty good idea for a lot of people. Like a lot of people who envisioned the suburbs originally, especially in like the 19th century, had these really lofty ideas and ideals. And now we have our modern suburbs, which is kind of not exactly what they had in mind.
Right. You start out as something good, Anakin Skywalker, that's the suburbs. And then the sprawl is Darth Vader, right? What the suburbs turned into. Let me reintroduce you. If you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. My guest is Jason Diamond. He's the author of The Sprawl, Reconsidering the Weird American Suburbs. Listeners, we can take your calls for author Jason Diamond at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Do you think the suburbs get a bad rap? Or do they deserve their reputation as bland and conformist? Join the conversation at 800-222-9455, or you can tweet us at 21st Show. You were mentioning just a moment ago, the suburbs once represented an optimistic vision of the future. You cover some of the sort of religious utopian origins of some summers. I'm interested, though, more so in the post-war era, right, when the Jetsons are on TV. Can you talk about that? Why were people drawn to the suburbs? What were their hopes for the suburbs?
Well, we spent so many years in the cities. I mean, America really has three defining eras, and there's the more colonial era, the early days where we were settling the country, where white Americans were building the cities up, and also moving further out west. Then we have, the urban era, which is predominantly where everything was concentrated in cities. And that lasted up until around the Second World War. And then more people, and I make the point to mention this in the book, mostly white Americans were given this option to get loans and to buy these houses that were, built pretty effortlessly compared to in the past. Sort of the Levittown idea that kind of took from Henry Ford's conveyor belt idea of, you just do this, you do that, you do this, and you have a house. And you can own that house for a small amount of money, and that house represents the American dream. And, that was we live in a time where all you ever read about is how millennials and Gen Z people aren't able to buy homes, and home ownership is barely even an option. And after the Second World War, it was. And as many people that could decided that's the dream they wanted. That was the piece of the American idea that spoke to them, was moving out to these suburbs. And they did it en masse. And yeah.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned the idea that this is something that was, at least in some ways, limited to white people. And I do want to come back to that idea of exclusion and who gets counted in the suburbs, both in reality and in sort of in the popular imagination. But I want to stick with this generational. You mentioned, you know, the idea that people in the millennial and Gen Z generation, you know, there's a lot of stories that they can't even afford to think about buying a house. But it was even before that, right? I'm on the very young side of Gen X. You're on the, I think, the Gen X millennial borderland, you describe it.
Yeah, I'm on the bridge.
Yeah. So, I mean, by the time we are in the suburbs, you know, the promise of the suburbs has lost some of its luster as that it had for our parents and grandparents, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think when you look at, and you know, I use culture as a way to sort of focus on where we are at. And that's why I use pop culture references so much throughout the book. But I mean, if you listen to a lot of music, if you watch movies, you know, I mentioned Back to the Future. One of my personal favorite movies that's maybe not as popular as Back to the Future is, I believe, 1984 or 85, pardon me if I'm wrong, the movie nerds will probably come after me, but Repo Man, which stars Emilio Estevez, like movies like that, they tended to sort of take this darker view of suburbia. And even before that, you know, you started seeing it with American writers like John Cheever even Judy Blume. That, you know, the famous, you know, one of the most famous YA novels has this great adult novel called Wifey, which is a pretty dark, almost kind of satirical look at the suburbs as well. And, you know, it was growing. It started really growing in the 60s with the counterculture. But by the 80s and 90s, the suburbs, I mean, you know, I'd go into the city from the suburbs and I would literally hear people tell me to go back to the suburbs. But I thought about that a lot when I was writing this book.
Huh. Go back to the suburbs. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Stigma.
So I'm glad you mentioned some of the literature that comes out of the suburbs. A fair amount of it is about fear. I guess I wanted to ask you, you write about this in the book. When you were growing up in the suburbs in the 1980s, what were you most afraid of? What were the things that you and maybe was instilled in you by family and the culture at large to be afraid of?
I mean, the first thing that always comes to mind is strangers. We were told that strangers were bad. And that, you know, I grew up in the shadow of Adam Walsh being kidnapped and murdered, you know, and that played a huge part in my upbringing. I mean, my parents... Other parents talked about these kinds of things. You know, we grew up in the shadow of satanic panic, and we grew up, you know, hearing that people that you didn't know were maybe up to no good and were going to could do bad things to you. And, you know, that was a very legitimate fear when I was a kid, that if a stranger talked to you, they wanted to do you harm. And I think about that a lot as a very... you know, as somebody who loves to talk to people as an adult, I will talk to anybody. I find it really strange that, you know, I grew up kind of being told to fear people, essentially, and, you know, for good reason in some ways. But in hindsight, it's really strange to me that was the thing I was the most afraid of, was other people.
Yeah, I share that. Stranger danger, I think, is, yeah. Do you think underlying this... or maybe I'll just ask it in a more open-ended way. What do you think was underneath that fear that was instilled into people's children? I mean, was there something deeper going on beyond too many episodes of America's Most Wanted playing on the television?
I think there was a lot of things. I mean, I think, you know, as Americans, I think, you know, we have this really interesting history where when we move on to a new chapter, we sort of try to forget about the last chapter as soon as possible. I mean, we're seeing it right now. I mean, I see it on Twitter, just the way people are talking about politics. I'm like really interested in, we have a new president, and people, you kind of see the conversation shifting away from ones you saw even a year ago. And I think when you do that, as much as Americans have done that, You kind of have this sort of accumulation of things, and the things maybe we didn't take care of in the last chapter of our history are kind of lurking in the shadows or beneath the surface or whatever metaphor you want to use. But, you know, I talk about this in the book. I find that when you're watching movies or reading books about the suburbs, especially in the 1980s, and my favorite example of this is the movie, the series A Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, which is literally about a child murderer who was killed by the parents and who comes back to haunt the children that the parents don't talk about this killer, and the killer comes back to haunt the kids and murder the kids. You know, there's something a little deeper there than just Freddy Krueger and his terrifying knife hands. Like, there's something deeper there. And, you know, I'm very fascinated by that because I'm kind of fascinated by the psychology of America and what we tend to hide from and not think about.
All right, let me reintroduce you. This my guest is Jason Diamond. He's the author of The Sprawl, Reconsidering the Weird American Suburbs. If you are from a suburb or maybe you're just living in a suburban-like environment, I'd love to hear from you if you have questions for Jason, or if you just want to share your thoughts on what it was like growing up in an area like that or living in an area like that right now. The phone lines are open at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also always tweet us at 21st Show. We're going to take a short break. More to come with Jason Diamond. This is the 21st. We'll be right back. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with author Jason Diamond. He is an Illinois native from the suburbs of Chicago. He's the author most recently of The Sprawl, Reconsidering the Weird American Suburbs. We are going to get to the good parts of the suburbs, which is part of the argument in his book. But before we do, I want to hold on this idea that we were talking about before the break of fear in the suburbs. And, you know, a lot of the literature and culture that comes out of the suburbs, or at least is inspired by the suburbs or set in the suburbs in some cases, is about fear. Like Shirley Jackson's The Lottery. There's also a classic episode of The Twilight Zone you talk about, written by Rod Serling. Let's take a listen.
Maple Street, in the last calm and reflective moment before the monsters came. At the sound of the roar and the flash of light, it will be precisely 6:43 p.m. on Maple Street.
Steve, what was that?
I guess it was a meteor, honey. Came awful close, didn't it?
Much too close.
He never did come out to look at that thing that flew overhead. He wasn't even interested. He always was an oddball. Yeah, why didn't he come out with the rest of us to look? What do you say we go ask him?
Wait a minute!
Now, let's not be a mob.
Your wife's been doing a little talking, Steve, about some of the odd things you've been doing.
Go ahead. What's my wife said? Let's get it all out. Let's pick out every idiosyncrasy of every man, woman, and child on this whole street. You're all set to find a scapegoat. You're all desperate to point some kind of a finger at a neighbor.
Of course, that is The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street from The Twilight Zone. And spoiler alert, the monsters are us. Jason, are all suburbanites a flash of light and a power outage away from going at each other with shotguns and hammers?
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, you know, I think if the last year has taught us anything, that's probably not the case. You know, we've made it through a pandemic and there hasn't been full scale rioting in suburbs and burning down Home Depots, across America. I think people in the suburbs are the same as people anywhere else, honestly. We deal with, I think it is easy to say people in these small little groups that really don't know each other that well would be at each other's throats in a second. But I think I've definitely seen in the last year especially that we all react to terror and tragedy in a certain way. And I think, that's something I've actually kept in mind over the last, 10 months that I've been sitting in my apartment thinking about all this, is that, that's one thing that we can hold on to. There are some obviously isolated incidents where that's not the case. And there are people who are obviously have their own opinions on this, but I am glad to see that, there hasn't been a Monsters or Do on Maple Street scenario when it comes to COVID.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that, I think you're right about that. Although, I mean, we did see early on, and you talk about in your book after 9/11, some of the, scapegoating of people, maybe not even from the Middle East, but just maybe who kind of vaguely looked like that in the imagination of some of their, fellow townsfolk were being targeted for harassment or worse. I mean, there are moments like this that come up in culture or in our history, I should say.
Yeah, absolutely. But those could happen in the city as well. And they
sure.
did.
Yeah.
I was just really concentrated, obviously, because of the book. I was really fascinated by the reaction post 9/11 for a lot of reasons. I mean, one being we weren't as dependent on the internet at that point. We weren't getting information as fast. So I used the example of Boca Raton, Florida, where a family of mine live, and they shut down the mall during Halloween because they were worried about attack. There was just all this panic that there were going to be attacks because some of the hijackers had gone to school in South Florida for learning to fly airplanes, and word spreads that there are more sleeper cells and this and that. It was really interesting to kind of go back and look at that and see how people reacted.
Sure. All right, let's go to the phones at 800-222-9455. Edward is on the line. Edward, thanks for calling in. I understand you're from a small town west of Chicago.
Yeah, about 70 miles west.
Okay.
In a town that I live in the core of the old town. It's a town with there's no mall, there's no commuter train to the city. And yet often people from the city assume that they define anything outside the city as a suburb. I wanted to ask what your view on the distinction between suburbs and small towns is, if you make one.
Sure. All right, Jason, what do you make of the do you draw a distinction between small towns and suburbs? Where is the borderland?
Yeah, I mean, again, like I said earlier with the definition, like there's no one real definition for these things. But I think small towns, in my opinion, this is, I think if you live in a small town and you have a different opinion, that's totally probably even more valid than mine. But I think a small town to me has a more established community. Maybe it's been around longer. It doesn't have, it's not something that kind of was just built by a developer in 1960 or 1970 or 1980. And it has more of a community feel. Like you don't have to drive 10 miles down one big stretch of box stores like you would in some suburbs to get to one other place. But I also have to say that there are small towns that want to become suburbs. I do talk about one also in Northern Illinois that I used to live in, that, I think used to be, prior to about 1950, used to be more rural and more farmland, and then decided it wanted to build up more. And I think that had a negative impact in the long run on that area.
I want to now move on to some of the, I've been a little negative and focusing on some of the, you know, Shirley Jackson and the monsters are due on Maple Street, but you do have you do range across a wider array of pop culture than that in the book. And I want to talk through a few of these for listeners who might need reminding. Who was John Hughes? What was his vision of suburbia?
John Hughes was the director of, every teen movie you've ever seen from post 1985, John Hughes is pretty much the influence on all of them, from Pretty in Pink and Ferris Bueller to 16 Candles. And also he did Home Alone, which is a personal favorite of mine. John was originally from Michigan, but he moved to Chicago and became an adopted Chicagoan. Ferris Bueller, the character, is a suburban kid who ends up having the greatest adventure in a city that anybody's ever had, which is to me like the perfect like, just that's what a suburban kid dreams of, is skipping school.
Oh, did we lose you there? Okay, I think we had a digital interruption in our connection with author Jason Diamond. So let me just take this opportunity to reintroduce him while our engineer attempts to reestablish contact. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with author Jason Diamond. He is a native of Illinois, the northern suburbs of Chicago. He's written the books Searching for John Hughes, also The Sprawl, Reconsidering the Weird American Suburbs. And that is what we have mainly been talking about today. While we are attempting to reconnect him, I'm just going to pause with that conversation and make a pitch for joining our texting group. You can do that by sending the word talk to 217-803-0730. That's send the word talk to 217-803-0730. We've gotten a lot of great texts this week for our segment earlier this week on running for office, running for a smaller office. We read them on air. We are on Monday planning to do a segment, and I'm pretty sure we'll be sending out a text to solicit questions for that on sort of updating people on vaccines. What is the status of COVID vaccines? We're hoping to speak with Illinois Department of Public Health Director Ngozi Ezike and others. We know a lot of people out there are desperately trying to find out when their place in line is going to come up. Maybe you've heard on the news that your place in line should be up, but the vaccine supply isn't there. We'll try and get some answers about when that will be. On that note, if you do have questions about vaccines, you can get them to us by joining our texting group, or you can always send an email to talk@21stshow.org, or better yet, leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. That's 217-300-2121 is our voicemail number. And I understand that we now have Jason Diamond back with us, so I will reintroduce him again. He's the author of The Sprawl, Reconsidering the Weird American Suburbs. And we lost your connection there. I'm going to take the opportunity to sort of jump ahead, because we only have about 4 minutes left in our conversation, to talk about who is counted as suburban, right? Both in reality, who was allowed to actually move there, or redlining prevented a lot of African Americans in mid-century from moving to certain suburbs, but also who we think of as suburban. And can you talk about how that's evolved over time, both in reality and in the sort of popular conception of what we think of as the suburbs?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and sorry about the disconnect. I don't know what happened there, but you mentioned redlining, and that's basically a really great way to start. But that was something that was put in place during this era when supposedly everybody was able to, have a piece of the American pie, so to speak. But it goes back even further than that. I mean, if you there are some towns that I research, even towns that I lived in, where it was written into the town charter, or it was well known that there were gentlemen's handshake deals that black people couldn't move in. That even, I'm Jewish, and I lived in neighborhoods that even 50 years earlier, I might not have been able to live in, which is kind of insane to me to think about in a lot of ways. But, you know, that was something that happened for a really long time, and discriminating against who could and couldn't live in your in your subdivision or in your neighborhood was a thing that was allowed for the most part, or if it wasn't, it went relatively, you know, nobody spoke about it. It was known who couldn't and couldn't live in place, who couldn't live in places. And I think that had a lasting impact. You know, we looked at the suburbs and we just saw one kind of person. We saw white people. And that's just really not the case. I mean, I've been all over the country, and there are suburbs, you know, in Michigan that have massive Middle Eastern people populations, or you see lots of African Americans living in the suburbs, or you see large Latino populations in certain suburbs, and it's only growing. And I think it kind of speaks to where we are as a country. As you know, we always looked at the cities as the melting pot, but I think the more the suburbs become looked at less as just this white place, you know, this place for white people, once we start realizing that these places are far more diverse than that in a lot of cases, I think the suburbs will sort of be looked at as just as much of a melting pot in many ways.
I think that's a great place to end our conversation. There's so much more in the book that we didn't get to talk about, so I do want to recommend it to listeners. Jason Diamond is the author of The Sprawl, Reconsidering the Weird American Suburbs. It's out now. Jason, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
You too. And that is it for this week, listeners. Like I said, we are planning to bring you a segment on COVID vaccines on Monday. If you have questions about that, send an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. Better yet, leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. The number again, 217-300-2121. Our program is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Chantal Vaca is our engagement producer. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi and Brielle Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk to you again next week.